a poem by Tao Qian entitled Reading the Classics of Mountains and Seas. It's early summer. Everything's lush. Our house set deep among broad trees. Birds delight in taking refuge here. I too love this little place. And now the plowing and planting are finished. I can return to my books again and read. Our meager lane, nowhere near well-worn roads, most old friends turn back. Here I ladle out spring wine with pleasure and pick vegetables out in the garden. And coming in from the east, thin rain arrives on a lovely breeze. My eyes wander. Tales of Emperor Mu float along on mountains and seas pictures. Look around, all time and space within sight. If not here, where will joy come? If not here, where will joy come? So this year, as most of you know, perhaps not our newer people, as I was saying, as most of you know, maybe not our newer people, but others know that this year at Seattle Insight, we're exploring transcendental dependent arising, which is the path that leads us from suffering to liberation, out of the wheel of samsara and to freedom. So in February, we worked with faith, in March with joy or pamoja. In April, we worked with rapture or piti, in May with tranquility, and this month, our topic is happiness or sukha. Last week, Nina gave us a great talk to get us started on this topic, and I almost feel like I should just say, okay, sukha, it's what she said, and just leave it at that. But that's probably not the best plan for today, and I know for myself, too, that when it comes to the Dhamma, it's always good to hear similar things said again in slightly different ways. We need to hear it many times. I know I need to hear it many times. So I'll be doing some of that this morning, maybe saying things we've heard before, but maybe in slightly different ways. And the subject of sukha, too, it's such a joy to talk about it. Think about it. So as we mentioned before, this path of transcendent dependent arising includes three kinds of joy. So much joy, really, which is amazing. First, there was pamoja, the joy of finding and following the path of the Dhamma. Then we talked about piti or rapture, joyful interest. Joyful interest, energy, bliss, the delight we feel as concentration deepens and we're really connecting with our experience. And now sukha, which is often translated as happiness. So what is this kind of joy called sukha? What makes it different from the other forms of joy? We got a sense of that last week, and to add to that, here are some of the definitions I've found for sukha. Ease, contentment, a sense of well-being and inner peace, happy contentment of body and mind. It differs from piti or rapture in that it's quieter and more subtle. It's calming rather than energizing. I was reading the section on sukha in Bhikkhu Bodhi's essay on transcendent dependent arising, and in it he says that According to the Abhidhamma, to the Buddhist psychology, piti is considered to be more of a mental formation, where sukha is more related to the vedanas, or feeling tones of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And this might sound like a very kind of obscure and scholarly kind of observation, like, well, who cares about that, you know? But after giving it some thought, I could see that this made sense and was actually kind of helpful in understanding what sukha is and how it differs from piti. And as I understand it, this statement that sukha is more like a vedana means that sukha is just this simple feeling of pleasantness, and there's not much else added. Piti, on the other hand, is more complex. It has this sense of interest in what's being known, feelings of delight, anticipation of more delight. It might trigger visions and fantasies and all sorts of things. So it can involve all kinds of mental activity. If we go back to that analogy of the person traveling through the desert that we've talked about several times over this year, where they see the oasis in the distance. There's a lot of excitement when they see the oasis. There's anticipation of the relief to come, and they're likely to start picturing in their mind that cool water, the palm trees, the shade, all of that good stuff they're looking forward to. In other words, all those things that we might think of as mental formations, things we associate with rapture or piti. But once they actually get to that oasis and quench their thirst and they're resting in the shade, there's none of that. There's just this sense of relief and contentment and pleasantness. And that's sukha. So you kind of really get a feeling for it from this. It says in the Upanishad Sutta that tranquility is a supporting condition for sukha. And sometimes it's a little hard to understand how one step in this sequence is a supporting condition for the next. I know I sometimes struggle with rapture as a supporting condition for tranquility. In theory, maybe I can see it, but in practice, a lot of the times I really struggle with allowing the rapture to calm down into tranquility. But with tranquility and sukha, it feels a lot clearer to me. In fact, I feel like these two states are so close it's hard to separate them. Even the words we use to describe them are similar. Ease, contentment, well-being. These are some of the words we use to describe sukha, but I think we've also used these words when talking about tranquility. Maybe we can think of tranquility as being more about just this sense of calm and composure. Well, sukha has more the quality of knowing this state as something that's quietly pleasant. And I know for myself, I experience it this way. It's not dramatic. In fact, it's pretty subtle. A lot of quiet contentment. Nice. As Nina described so beautifully last week, sukha is an important quality in both our formal meditation practice and in our daily lives. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about each of these today. First, to start with our formal meditation. In our formal meditation practice, sukha is a state we reach as concentration deepens, and it follows the states of rapture and tranquility. And as I said before, one of the ways that sukha is commonly described is as happy contentment of body and mind. And it's also talked about as a state that's what there when the hindrances have been abandoned or quieted. So you might say that sukha is what's naturally there when the mind isn't troubled by craving or aversion or restlessness and worry or sloth and torpor or doubt. And in our meditation practice, we spend a lot of time working with these hindrances, trying to understand them, to calm them, to free ourselves from the hold that they can have over our minds. And in his commentary on Transcendent Dependent Arising, Bhikkhu Bodhi talks about two ways that we can do this working with hindrances. And one way, which I think we're all pretty familiar with, is by working with each hindrance separately as it arises. And this would include recognizing and bringing mindfulness to that hindrance. It might also include applying antidotes to the particular hindrance that might help to alleviate it a bit. For example, if craving arises, we might remember that that thing that we're wanting so much actually is pretty impermanent, and the pleasure we'll get from it is just not going to last that long. If we feel aversion, we might also remember impermanence, or we might cultivate compassion and kindness for ourselves as we're suffering all this not wanting, not liking. If it's appropriate, we might even offer compassion for the object of our aversion. We might notice how uncomfortable craving is if we're not lost in the fantasies about whatever it is we're wanting. We might also notice how unpleasant aversion feels, sometimes worse than the actual unpleasant thing that brought it on. I suspect a lot of us have had that experience, sitting in meditation and being disturbed by some little ache in the back or a little ache in the knee, or maybe some kind of irritating sound while we're meditating, and getting more and more upset about it and more angry about it and more feeling like this thing shouldn't be there and I just can't stand this thing. And then all of a sudden we realize, wait a minute, this big storm in my mind is actually way more unpleasant than that little noise or that little pain. And when we see that, it's like, okay, let's just go back. Let's just be with what is. If we feel sleepy or sluggish, we might do things to arouse energy, like opening our eyes or standing up. If we feel restlessness and worry, we might try turning our minds from our worried thoughts to something else that can calm us, like the breath or just the openness of sound. If we feel doubt, we can ask questions and clarify whatever it is we're not sure of. And there are other methods too, and I expect that you have your own techniques that you use when you're working with the hindrances. And when we do this kind of investigation, we really learn a lot about the things that are painful for us and stop us from seeing clearly. And gradually it becomes easier to deal with things like craving and aversion, restlessness when they arise, because we understand something about them. We have some wisdom about them. Another method of dealing with these hindrances is by developing deeper concentration and continuity of mindfulness. And it's a process of really unifying and stabilizing the mind so it's more and more fully present with whatever's arising in the moment. All of that liking and not liking, the thoughts about whatever is arising, the memories, the planning to get more of it or to get rid of it, these kind of fade into the background. As Bhikkhu Bodhi puts it, the unification of the mind upon a single object, or in the case of Vipassana practice, on that display of changing objects that we follow with our attention, it closes off the portal through which the hindrances emerge. So the mind is so fully absorbed in knowing each particular moment that there isn't a whole lot of room for anything else. And while that concentration continues, the mind is secure from the disturbances of the hindrances. And in the absence of the hindrances, there's happiness, there's ease, there's contentment. In this situation, there's the sense of not so much working with the hindrances, but more that as we keep practicing, deepening our concentration and continuity of mindfulness, the hindrances just kind of fade away on their own or kind of fade into the background. And I think many of us have experienced something like this, had tastes of something like this, when we've been on retreat or when we've done any more extended period of practice, like maybe a day long or a weekend. As mindfulness becomes strong, the hindrances just don't arise as much. They're not nearly as powerful. And we feel a sense of calm, contentment, and happiness in things just as they are. Now, of course, that level of concentration and continuity in mindfulness doesn't last forever. Conditions change, the retreat ends, our minds go back to their everyday state, but even so, we get a sense of that kind of happiness, that happiness that's beyond conditions. We have a sense that it's possible. And having at least some of this state of contentment really prepares the mind to concentrate even more deeply so it can really see into the truth of things the truth of things as they are. And Nina mentioned this a little bit last week, and it's something we'll be talking about more in the coming months. So sukha is a really important mind state in our formal meditation practice, and something that really sets the stage for our minds to really see purely and clearly. But it's also a state of mind that we can cultivate in daily life. And as Nina mentioned last week, in the Buddha's teachings, he talks about worldly or mundane happiness and unworldly happiness. And this isn't with the sense that worldly happiness is bad, only that it's impermanent and conditional, so it doesn't really give lasting satisfaction. Christina Feldman has a really good talk on sukha on Dharma Seed, which you might be able to access if you'd like to listen to it, in which she talks about how our experiences of worldly or mundane happiness can give us a taste of sukha. We might get a sense of it when we're appreciating a pleasant or beautiful experience, like listening to music or seeing a lovely sunset or being in nature. Of course, these experiences don't last. And if we try to make them last by trying to hang on to them or to replicate them, we'll just cause ourselves suffering. But in those moments when we're just appreciating what we're experiencing, and feeling content and happy with what's present, we get a sense of sukha. For lay people, the Buddha also highlighted four forms of worldly well-being that can give us a sense of sukha. One of these is the peaceful conscience we have from leading an ethical life, which Nina talked about last week. And this is really important, not only because of the harm we do when we don't lead an ethical life, the harm to ourselves and the harm to others, but also because when we're doing things that we know we really shouldn't be doing, we got a lot to worry about and a lot to feel guilty about. And it's really hard for our minds to settle when all of this stuff is going on. The other forms of worldly well-being that the Buddha mentioned are the happiness and security of having the resources we need to take care of ourselves, the joy of using those resources to care for our friends and family, and the relief of not being in debt. So very practical things, and it's easy to see how these can give us a sense of contentment, release, and relief and gratitude, at least to the extent that we have these blessings and we can actually recognize them. In our current conditions of such economic uncertainty and so many ups and downs and unknowns, this can be kind of difficult. Some of us really don't have that security of knowing we have the resources we need. Some of us have the resources now, but can't really appreciate it because we're so worried about what might happen in the future. Some of us have the resources, but just take it for granted. So these teachings about appreciating the resources we have and our ability to share them really encourages us to really think about our blessings and feel the joy that comes from appreciating them and from sharing in our good fortune. And Sukha also includes the ability to appreciate the goodness of life in the moment, something we might recognize in all kinds of ways that we can really cultivate in our daily life. We can take time to recall our blessings and feel gratitude. This can be for really basic and simple things. The financial security I just mentioned, as well as health, friends and family, or just a nice cup of tea or a sunny day. It can be as simple as starting to recognize the good things in our lives instead of always focusing on what's not so good. As Nina said last week, we can notice what isn't wrong in this moment. And when we do this, we might begin to sense that, yes, we really do have enough. We are enough. And that right now, this moment is enough. An attitude of gratitude can really go a long way in cultivating sukha. It's kind of like the poem I read after our meditation. The author is celebrating the beautiful things in his life. His comfortable little house, the satisfaction of completing plowing and planting, harvesting vegetables from the garden, a refreshing breeze, the pleasure of reading a favorite book. Simple things, things that are not far from most of us. And he says, look around, all time and space within sight. If not here, where will joy come? And one of the things that I've noticed since we've been working with Tranquility and Sukha here at Seattle Insight is that I've been experiencing these mind states more and more frequently. And I don't think it's because conditions in my life have changed so much or that I've had any kind of huge revelation. It's just that I'm more aware of them, more aware of the small good things because we've been working with it, studying it. Just the tiny stuff, like looking up and thinking, oh, what beautiful clouds, or that freshly cut grass smells so good, or you know, I really like the art on my walls. Noticing and appreciating those small moments of contentment instead of letting them get lost in worry or irritation or the feeling of wanting something more or better. It's not a dramatic feeling at all. It's subtle, but so nice. And such a relief in comparison with all the anxiety and dissatisfaction that could so easily be there instead. Not that those aren't present in my mind plenty of times, but it's also wonderful to realize that joy and contentment are also there, more than I often realize. You know sometimes how a song gets into your head and won't go away? Well, near the beginning of the retreat with Carrie and Tim, this happened to me. This old song from the 60s came into my mind, Ichiku Park, which maybe some of you of a certain vintage might remember. And I'm not going to sing it for you because if I tried to do that, you'd just flee the Zoom room as fast as you could. But it has this refrain, It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. And that kept playing over and over in my mind. It's kind of funny because apparently this park is a real place and it's nicknamed Ichiku Park because it's full of stinging nettles. And Ichiku is the local slang name for stinging nettles there in East London where the park is. And believe me, I know stinging nettles, and It's All Too Beautiful is the last thing I think about stinging nettles. But the sentiment, yeah. There are those moments in this life, in this practice, when, yeah, all too beautiful. So we can find a taste of sukha this way. And the more we recognize those small moments of happiness and contentment, the more often we experience them fully. They're not always there, of course, but they are there. It can be easy to feel like maybe we don't deserve them, or that our circumstances right now are so difficult that we can't access them. Or maybe we feel like feeling happiness and contentment, when we do that, we're ignoring or being indifferent to the pain in the world. And of course, we don't want to try to use our practice is kind of a screen or sort of a Pollyanna type way of seeing to block everything out. But also, if all we see is pain, then that pain will overwhelm us. And so often recognizing those small moments of contentment and joy is the thing that really sees us through the times when things aren't so happy and aren't so pleasant, those times when our predominant experiences are grief or loss or fear. So appreciating the value of seeing the small moments of joy. And we can also know that sukha goes beyond the lovely summer day or the small comfortable home or the beautiful poem. It's a sense of well-being and peace that can be there even when circumstances are difficult, more stable and deeper than the happiness that comes with pleasant experience. And it points to something that even goes beyond the sense of happiness we experience in deep concentration. It points to a happiness born of deep wisdom, where the mind is really free of greed, hatred, and delusion. It points to an unconditioned and unshakable peace. And perhaps we have a taste of this too, or a sense of the potential for this, as we explore sukha in our meditation, in our daily life. Look around all time and space with insight. If not here, where will joy come? Let's just sit for a moment. Okay, well, we have a little bit of time now to share with each other anything that you would like to share about your practice or your discussions, any questions you might have. The floor is open, and you can use your virtual hand to let me know that you have something that you would like to say, or I can see you all here, so you could also just hold up your hand too. Yes, Suze.
We all talked about the joy in some really ordinary things in each of our lives. Somebody else's ordinary wouldn't be mine, but it was theirs. The simple, ordinary, creative, just, and having the ability to do those things. And I also shared about a couple awarenesses from my practice that just gave me so much joy of realizing that some behaviors that I were unpleasant and probably harmful on an emotional level aren't really, it's not my go-to anymore. So that just the joy of seeing that the practice works.
Yes. That's a big joy, a huge joy. Yeah, thank you, Suze. Charlotte?
Yes. You said there's something about appreciating the small things in life and taking notice of them. And I've been trying to do that with being outside and looking at the bees and looking at whatever is there for me to see and give me joy. I have one experience I think I shared with the group is that I saved a bumblebee once. I don't know if I told this story before or not, but I was walking down this sidewalk and there was this bee going back and forth, obviously lost. And I know that a lot of bees nest in the ground or under bushes. So I picked it up and I carried it over to this bush and it just scurried right in. Oh, happy bee, happy bee. So that whenever I pass by that sidewalk, I remember that happy bee. And it gives me joy.
Oh,
thank
that's
you.
Sweet. That's sweet. Thank you for sharing that. That's so beautiful. I'd like to, oops, you muted yourself.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Okay.
I'd just like to say that I think maybe some of us will remember that happy bee going into the bushes now. You, Charlotte, so thank you for sharing that.
We will. That's so nice how the joy that comes from having a sense of caring for other creatures too. That's a really beautiful kind of happiness. Really lovely. Yes, Candace.
On that theme, I last night I was noticing that my cat was distressed about something, but I just couldn't figure out what it was. And I finally, she was standing on my feet, so I just picked her up and I held her. And I started rubbing various parts of her body and she's purring. And then I get to her tummy and she kind of tightened just a little bit, but she wanted me to touch it. And I found this pine tar on her tummy. This,
oh my gosh.
A lump of pine tar in her fur. So, you know, took her to the bathroom and got Charlie and I was able to comb it out. And I was just, she was just like, after that, just kind of lying across this rug like, oh, I feel so much better. And it filled me with such joy to have noticed and picked her up and then kind of tested parts of her and then to just be able to get rid of it. It was just without really hurting her much. It was just felt great. It felt like when I bargained with, when I'm trimming the catmint and I'm bargaining with the bees, I'll take these blossoms, you can have them. You understand. I'll cut those tomorrow, you can have them today.
Oh, sweet. Yes, Amy.
Hi. So one of the things, I'm going to rephrase this from what I said in our conversation, but one of the things that I am aware of right now is how comparing mind is present for me. And, you know, a lot of it is built up over my life, right? Like I have all these life experiences and different relationships that I've had. I've lived in a number of different places. And when I'm when I'm in that, when it comes up, the comparing mind, it's like this veil or vision that creates almost like delusion, and I don't actually experience what is happening. And to me, that's like that is an impediment. It keeps me from feeling happy, I feel like. And I was just curious if you like had anything you wanted to say about like sort of breaking through, maybe when someone is, you know, experiencing dukkha of some time, and like, or resources or something like that.
Well, what you say about that comparing mind coming up and creating a veil so we don't fully experience whatever is happening in the present moment is so, I mean, yes. And I think we all experience that. We all experience that. And the moments when we break through that are actually kind of the beautiful and rare moments. You know, and just, I think partly just recognizing that the mind is doing that and that this is a source of dukkha is a big thing right there, because a lot of times we don't even think that this even is a problem. We're just like, oh, you know, that's what we do. That's what we do, you know. But as Philip Moffat says, it's good to renounce it for a while. In certain ways, like some of the concentration and continuity really helps with that, because I find that if my mind is really interested in with whatever is happening, it's not worrying about comparing. But that tendency is so ingrained in us that I think that it's sort of like every once in a while we break out, and the more we see it as an impediment instead of something that's really valuable, the quicker we are to let it go. But it's I think this is a big struggle for everybody. And no quick fix. Charlotte.
Yes, thank you. I was just, when you were talking there, Lyndall, and Amy, I was thinking, can we have compassion for the mind that is doing that? And thank it for its what it wants to do for us. And just compassion. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. That's a great suggestion. That's always important, to have compassion for the parts of our minds that maybe have good intentions, but they really just don't quite get it. Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Charlotte. It looks like we're about at the end of our time together, too. One more. Okay, Suze.
I just wanted to add, I want to thank Amy for bringing up about comparing mind. And as I work with it, I've been noticing the delusion part of comparing, that believing that whatever I'm comparing myself and my circumstances to, I'm imposing these ideas on it, which probably are wrong. And even though, you know, so sometimes I just look at the deluded part or remind myself, I really have no idea who this person is, what this situation is. I have my own filter for believing that it's better than mine, but it may not be. So just wanted to throw that piece in too.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, all of that stuff, delusion. I think that's the hardest thing. The hardest thing to deal with. I mean, craving, aversion, they're kind of clear. You kind of see them. They're very challenging, but delusion is even harder to recognize. So thank you, everybody, for being here and for your comments and conversation. And I don't want to keep you over, so let's just take a moment to dedicate the merit of our practice. Maybe bringing to mind a particular person who perhaps is in need of compassion, as Charlotte was mentioning, or just in need of love in general. And offering to share the merit of our practice with them. May they find happiness. And then opening to all beings. May all beings share the merit of our practice. May they find peace and happiness.